We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovic. Joining me today is the man that needs no introduction, Rick Rule. He's an investor and speculator and founder and CEO of Rule Investment Media. Thanks for joining me today, Rick.
Always a pleasure, Tom. Thank you for having me back.
It's excellent to speak to you as always, and it's been a little while since our last interview. And I'd like to start by kind of getting a bit of perspective over your time since your retirement from being at Sprott full time. You've changed your direction to focus more on Rule Investment Media, and you told me last time that you want to be increasingly doing things that bring you joy. So where have you found some enjoyment and interest since making this move, and is it much different than what you found your time at Sprott doing?
I would say three important lessons, all of them beneficial. I was increasingly frustrated with regulated activity. I'm not saying necessarily that all regulation is wrong. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is that ill-founded regulation that gets between me and deserving and providing benefit to my customers is wrong. Mm-hmm. And I found myself increasingly paying attention to regulation rather than paying attention to my customers. And so I've resigned every part of my obligation that might be in any meaningful way regulated, which is lovely. I'm out from under all of those alphabet soup agencies, and I just try and provide value where I see fit. I have also managed to eliminate most of my managerial and administrative responsibilities. I've had periods of time when hundreds of people reported to me, and now I have one employee, and I, in fact, report to her, which is lovely. So I've sort of succeeded in my long-term goal, which is returning to adolescence, at least with responsibility. But the most important thing is I've been able to test a thesis that I've had for years, which is to say that you get by giving. I believe that you become a success in business by delivering for your customer, nothing more. And with Rule Investment Media, with absolutely no idea of what I would do to commercialize it, and I still have no idea what I'm going to do to commercialize it, by focusing on education, by focusing on giving something to the customer before I found something to charge for the customer for, I've built up a very large and very responsive database, and I get all kinds of inbound love and affection around things like educational videos, and around the portfolio rankings that I do. I will definitely find a way to monetize this over time, although I still have no real idea how. But it's really been an eye-opener to me to see that I could build, in retirement, a very large community simply by giving, mm-hmm. Not by trying to sell anybody anything. And I think the consequence of that is that I've built a very large and very valuable network, something that's been highly amusing to me.
Mm-hmm. That's excellent to hear, Rick. So were there big pieces of advice for investors that you weren't able to share while adhering to that regulatory framework that we were talking about?
Well, I think so. I hadn't recognized at the time. I always felt that I had an obligation to disclose to investors what it was I was investing in. But there was a fine line where the regulators believed in some way that that was front running or advertising. Given now that I don't charge companies corporate advisory fees and I don't charge customers commission, I can tell people precisely what I'm doing and why. Mm-hmm. And I think that's useful. Big picture prognostication is worth something if it helps people develop their own paradigm. But if I say to investors, I'm investing in even something as large as ExxonMobil, and here's why. And by the way, I'm not paid by ExxonMobil and I'm not charging you a commission. Mm-hmm. It's difficult to understand how any regulatory authority could have a problem with that. For me, if I talk about a big picture idea, which is like risk-adjusted net present value or free cash generation, if I talk about it in the abstract and I'm addressing an audience of 50,000 people, maybe 500 will care. But if I talk about those concepts in the context of a company like ExxonMobil, probably half the audience cares. And so I have the ability to discuss topics in a personal way and in a detailed way, a way that's more interesting to me and a way that is of much more use and interest to the customer, unconstrained by securities regulation, unconstrained too so far by profit, but that's okay.
Yeah, it's always, you know, doing the show as long as I have now, I find it's difficult for people to be able to pay attention to many different things. And, you know, the easier and maybe more explicit we can make things for people, the usually more palatable it is, right?
I think I'm the same. I'm all for an academic education. But if you pack an academic education into a model that might go up in price and pay me a dividend while I wait, for some reason, I pay better attention.
So, Rick, you've said many times that the importance of asking when questions and not if questions often leads to higher quality thinking. So can you talk to us a bit more about asking the right types of questions and how you've changed your thinking over the years to really encapsulate this theme?
Yeah, I love that question, by the way. Too many of us as speculators either don't want to do the hard work to determine what a when question is, or are attracted to the returns that might accrue to an event that's improbable, the 50 to 1 or 60 to 1 shot that has almost infinitesimal odds of being successful. What I've learned is that if I try and find a sector that's first of all out of favor, which is one, as an example, where I talk about it online and nobody cares, or better yet, one that's hated, I know that I have very few competitors. Buffett described the process by which he became rich initially as saying that he bought straw hats in winter. He was afraid when others were afraid, brave, and brave when others were afraid. In resources, I've taken it a bit further, and it's actually fairly easy to do if you get your intellect to overwhelm your emotions. Find a commodity that is necessary for the maintenance of the material standard of living of humankind, and will be for another 10 years, where the selling price of the commodity worldwide is less than the cost of production worldwide. That is an industry that's so bad that it's in liquidation. You know that over time, because these are depleting industries, either the price of the commodity will go up to the cost of production, including the cost of capital, or the commodity will become unavailable. The question is when, not if. That's a very high quality question. Most investors ask themselves questions to where there's no when answer. It's an if question. This might take place, and if it takes place, it's a wonderful thing. If you go back to March of 2020, when the whole world was alive with anti-COVID sentiment, anti-carbon sentiment, and the same time that the COVID drove down air traffic, you saw the oil industry, you saw the oil price momentarily going sub-zero. And there was a suspicion in the market that oil would never recover. And I went on numerous shows, probably yours, I don't recall specifically, saying, this is fairly simple. If you believe that 3 years from now or 4 years from now, when you walk downstairs to your garage and turn the key to the right, that your car will start, unless you are one of those seven people that own a Tesla, you believe in higher oil prices. The International Energy Agency at that point in time said that the fully loaded cost to produce a barrel of oil worldwide, not the lifting cost, but fully loaded cost, exploration cost, general and administrative expense, cost of capital, was almost $60 per barrel. If the industry was making the stuff for 20 and selling it for 60, they were losing $40 a barrel, 80 million times a day. That was getting fairly boring. Fairly obviously, the price had to go up or the cars wouldn't start. Beyond that, Exxon got kicked out of the Dow 30. It got replaced out of the Dow 30, which meant there was all kinds of index selling. That was a temporary phenomenon. It couldn't get kicked out again because it was already kicked out. That selling was going to get itself done in a month. At the same time, that the big spokesperson, I guess, for investing was that noted investment guru and physicist, Greta Thunberg, And demand for oil was constrained by COVID. It was obvious that this was a situation that was going to correct itself. So that's what I say when I say you need to concern yourself with questions where the answer begins with when, mm-hmm. not if. The price of oil had to go up. 3 years ago, when you and I talked about uranium, the price of uranium had to go up. It was selling for $18 a pound. It was costing the industry $55 to make a pound of uranium. Despite the fact that the big thinkers didn't like it, uranium contributed 20% of U.S. baseload power. There were only two choices. The price had to go up or the lights had to go out. Those were the two choices. Those are when questions, not if questions. The problem with that is that you can be, and I always am, early. And if you're early on a when question, you can suffer easily through share price declines. You can suffer through volatility. You can suffer through psychological turmoil. But I found that psychological turmoil is easier ultimately to deal with than fiscal turmoil. When I put myself in the way of a trade that has to come true, I often suffer through 2 years of torture and 4 years of bliss. Mm-hmm. Which would seem to me to be a more than fair trade-off.
Absolutely. I like your, you know, your framework, your thinking around that, Rick. And, you know, my next question was exactly in that same vein. Is there a particular setup that you find most interesting right now, whether it be that coming uranium supply deficit or maybe the possible re-recognition of gold's value in the mainstream? Is there one asset that strikes you as having a particularly interesting set of circumstances right now?
There's a plethora mm-hmm. of assets, which is lovely. Since you asked about them, I was a noted uranium bull. Then when the uranium price, and in particular the junior uranium equities, pardon the pun, exploded, I became a uranium skeptic, and I'm on the way to becoming a uranium bull again. Mm-hmm. The basket of junior equities in the uranium space is off by, 30-35%? Certainly headed in the right direction. The increase in the price of yellow cake has moderated, but I believe 2022 will see the pace of Japanese nuclear restarts come online, which will take care of the uranium price. So I think, particularly if the uranium juniors continue to fall, if the hot money, the dumb money leaves them, I think there's going to be a wonderful position to, a wonderful opportunity to reestablish positions in the uranium space. I think it'll take probably 2 years, 2.5 years to reap the rewards finally. So somebody's going to have to deal with a lot of volatility and a lot of pain in the interim, but I intend to establish, or rather reestablish, very meaningful positions in the uranium sector this year, mm-hmm. including in the material itself through the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust. Mm-hmm. You know, I love reading the comment on social media about the recent uranium bulls all of a sudden hating uranium. There's nothing in the world like a jilted lover to ignore the aspects of the narrative that caused them to be attracted to the narrative when it was overpriced. It just amazes me that when people buy financial assets, they'd rather pay more for them than pay less. But that being the case, it's a wonderful set of circumstances. So I expect, as the uranium equities prices fall, to establish meaningful positions in uranium equities, particularly in the uranium equities that played chicken with capital markets last year and forgot to finance. I think now that the sector's out of favor, when they have to finance, they'll come into the market in private placements, and they'll have to give me a warrant, which is the only reason why I might participate in a private placement, to be honest with you. So I'm attracted to uranium. I'm attracted for every single investor, the speculator, the income investor, the growth investor. I'm attracted to the oil and gas sector. The oil and gas equities, particularly in your country, in Canada, the mid-cap oil and gas equities are priced as though we were in a $45 or $50 U.S. WT market, or more particularly that we were in a $2.50 U.S. Nat gas, AECO market. And the markets that the producer's enjoying right now are closer to 70 than to 50. Mm-hmm. And even Canadian natural gas has found a bid. if you look at the share prices that you're seeing in the oil sector relative to the cash flow that these companies are generating, they're truly spectacular. Meanwhile, the cost of capital to the oil and gas space has gone up, which means that many companies are deferring sustaining capital investments, which means that supply constraints will continue. This is the best of all possible worlds for people who invest in well-run oil and gas companies, who maintain sustaining capital investments, who can continue to drill their high-quality inventory into supply shortages, who generate spectacular free cash and increasingly are willing to distribute some of that free cash by way of dividends to their owners. This is as good a climate in the oil and gas business as I have seen in my career since the early part of the 1990s, when literally nobody cared about the oil and gas. And I say this all the way from the Canadian names, the sort of Birch Cliffs and Peyto's of the world, all the way up to ExxonMobil. I think it's a wonderful time to be in the oil and gas business. I think you need to pick and choose because there's still an awful lot of oil companies. But it's difficult for me to find a time when net present value has been available in the enterprise values that are available today in the space. And then finally, you mentioned precious metals. It's difficult to me to figure out a situation that doesn't put us squarely at the end of a first half of a precious metals bull market, where typically you find a malaise or a decline, and the second half of a bull market. I say that not so much because of charts. I say it rather because precious metals traditionally have moved up in price when people are concerned about the purchasing power of their savings and conventional assets. And when I look at currencies, either the US dollar or the Canuck buck, but really looking broader, when I look at currencies around the world and I look at bonds or savings products denominated in those currencies, there's no way that your savings keep pace with inflation. The challenges are in order, and I want your listeners to write these down. The challenges include quantitative easing, which is a very fancy Trudeau or Biden phrase for counterfeiting. That's all it is. Debt and deficits. These debts at the federal level in Canada and the United States will never be repaid. They have to be rolled over. The most pernicious, of course, is negative real interest rates. If you're a U.S. saver in the benchmark instrument, the U.S. 10-year treasury, the government pays you 1.5% in a currency that's declining in value by 6.5% a year. The government guarantees that you'll lose 5% a year in purchasing power. So obviously, people have reason to be concerned about the purchasing power of their savings in conventional instruments. And this means, in my experience, almost certainly, that eventually, it doesn't have to happen next month or the month after, but eventually this is a when question. Mm-hmm. This is certainly a when question. I think I've mentioned on your show before, Tom, but let me do it again. The market share of gold and silver is another reason why I think they don't go higher, they go much higher. Over the last four decades, precious metals and precious metals related assets have comprised between 1.5% and 2% of total savings and investment assets in the U.S. market, which is to say their market share relative to other financial instruments has been between 1.5% and 2%. Today, they're at 0.5%. So, it isn't to say that the market share of precious metals needs to reclaim their old 1980 high. All they need to do is revert to mean. And if they revert to mean, which I believe they're going to do, demand will triple or quadruple in the largest savings and investment market in the world. I see that happening. I see, in particular, in the mid-cap gold space, the high-quality mid-cap gold space, companies where their net present value, I define net present value as the current value, discounted value of future cash flows from proven developable reserves and resources at current prices. I see net present values relative to enterprise value being market cap and debt minus cash, at the most attractive levels that I've seen them in 45 years in the business. But I believe the gold prices are going higher, which means even at current gold prices, relative to historic norms, they're cheap. But I see the precious metals prices going higher. So I would say I'm bullish across the commodity spectrum. The difference between me and many of your viewers is that despite the fact that I'm 68, crowding 69 very hard, as I have less time on earth, I become more patient. It's odd that younger people seem to have trauma holding an investment over a long weekend. And an older person such as myself, understanding the underlying arithmetic, becomes very patient. But I'm very patient and I'm very, very, very bullish.
Well, it's interesting, Rick. You know, you and I have spoken before about, you know, what would have to change in the overall, you know, economic landscape for you to become less bullish on gold. And it seems that there has never been a situation where you could be more bullish, correct?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I guess Alberta could reelect Ralph Klein. you know, they're has been from time to time circumstances where the electorate, having no second choice, did the honorable thing. But it's very rare. I'm, by the way, a long-term bull on the economy, Tom. I continue to see a circumstance where individually we're so tenacious and so creative that we overcome our collective stupidity. Ours is still a society where six or seven pimply-faced kids can take over a garage in Sunnyvale, California, and out pops Google. I'm not one of these who is forecasting the end of humankind. Mm-hmm. What I'm suggesting is a circumstance where we have to pay individually for our collective sins. And until we're of a mind to do that, you know, I think that precious metals will do very well. Our societies have to have a reckoning with collectivism. Your society, your generation needs to look at my generation. We need to look at the off-balance sheet liabilities of the Canadian government and the American government, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and its Canadian counterparts, and understand that debt and deficits is really a wealth transfer from young, productive people like yourself to older, somewhat less productive people like myself. And this needs to be dealt with. These transfer payments are unconscionably large, and they will absolutely positively result in lower living standards for younger people. Until this begins to be addressed, until the consciousness around this is understood, unfortunately, instruments that are regarded as anti-collectivist instruments, precious metals, will do well.
That's a great way to put it, Rick. I've heard you say before, though, that you're tempering your delight with fear when looking at the economic recovery that we have seen over, let's say, the last 2 years since the start of the pandemic. So do you feel that we are close to the culmination of several economic cycles that were stopped from fully cleansing the market and have now piled up into inflating, you know, simultaneous bubbles here?
That is a scare. I mean, the thing that could really disrupt the commodity thesis would be a worldwide recession or a worldwide depression, an absolute collapse in confidence. And that is one thing that I'm nervous about. I'm not an economist, so I'm not one to stand on a soapbox because I don't have one and say that 2008 is nigh. But a circumstance where you had a simultaneous loss of confidence that was expressed in a recession and expressed in a seizing up of credit, ironically, conventional credit around the world, would certainly derail my thesis. I am certainly one who believes that the excesses need to be wrought out of the economy. I believe it can happen, as we saw in 1980, in the early part of the 1980s, you don't need to eliminate or even reduce government spending. You need to reduce it as a percentage of GDP. In other words, you need to reduce its growth. If we allow individual initiative over time to rebound and increase our wealth as a society, we can grow our way out of our current circumstance. The thing that bothers me is that we're not doing it. We're trying to consume our way out of its current circumstance, and you don't consume your way out of debt. That's not the way it works. So thank you for asking that question. The big, big, big fly in the ointment would be a recession or a depression. And recessions are often the result of overly stimulative fiscal environments like the one that we've been in for a long time. I mean, I think ironically, the way out of that is probably in emerging and frontier markets. You know, I really, really, really believe that there's a chance that the next Google won't happen in Sunnyvale, that it will happen in Lagos or La Paz or Phnom Penh. I'm really attracted, as an example, to see the technology venture capital startups that are having and that are happening in Africa, and the ability that the bottom half of humankind, the ascent of the bottom half of humankind, both in terms of solvency, but also education. I really believe the way out for those of us in the developed world is to encourage the undeveloped world to unlock their potential. I think the way out for us is certainly not in Ottawa. It's certainly not in Washington. I think it's in Lagos and Phnom Penh and La Paz and places like that. And I'm very, very bullish about that.
Mm-hmm. So Rick, as part of, you know, our thinking about, let's say, the precious metals case in general, how do you think the rise of cryptocurrencies and the digital economy as a whole has affected the demand and attractiveness of the metals?
Those are two separate questions. So let's deal with them sequentially. With regards to the demand side, I think probably crypto and precious metals have competed on the speculative fringe, which is to say partially my audience, partially your audience, younger people who are attracted to alternative investments. But the truth is that the combined market capitalization of precious metals around the 8 trillion mark and the combined market capitalization of cryptos around the $3 trillion mark, you're talking about an $11 trillion market capitalization in a world where the total market capitalization of savings and investment assets worldwide is $650 trillion, which is to say the combined market capitalization of crypto and precious metals is infinitesimal. Mm-hmm. The gold market will move, not necessarily when the Reddit crowd, or if the Reddit crowd were to shift from crypto to gold. It will move when the Harvard University Endowment, China International Trade and Investment Corporation, Norges Bank, the big insurance companies of the world come to understand that their traditional reliance on a model that's 60% equity, 40% debt doesn't work when debt has a negative real net present value. When you begin to disintermediate the bond holdings of the biggest institutional investors in the world because of negative real interest rates, you will see a move into tangible assets that will make the silver squeeze, the alleged silver squeeze that we just, you know, went through, look silly. Mm-hmm. Now, the second part of this is a really interesting thing. I've invested a lot in it, and I don't really know what I'm doing. That has to do with the application of the distributed ledger and blockchain on the trade in gold and silver. I really do believe that eventually most savings and investment activities will switch from markets to the blockchain and the distributed ledger. The idea that you could have a storage intermediary, I would love to see it be Sprott, of course, but there will be various trusted storage intermediaries that develop precious metals and precious metals related tokens, which are effectively frictionless, and where trust in the exchange is community based via smart contracts. I think if you eliminate the friction that's present in precious metals, that precious metals again return to being money. I actually believe that the time will come very shortly, 5 or 6 years from now, when you can use a fraction of a silver coin to buy a cup of coffee, and that you can move precious metals back into being simultaneously a store of value and a medium of exchange. And I think that crypto, if you define crypto as the blockchain and the distributed ledger, will ultimately be the biggest allies that precious metals have, because it will democratize their use. They have always been a store of value, but they will be able to be returned to being a medium of exchange as a consequence of the distributed ledger.
So in your eyes, it's an and situation of the crypto world and the precious metals working together to increase the efficiency and seamlessness of being able to transact with the metals again, right?
Absolutely. And I certainly think that there is a future for cryptocurrencies too. I don't own them well, and I don't know them well enough to own them personally, but that doesn't matter. The fact is that I'm a consumer of currencies. I spend Canadian dollars, I spend euros, I spend US dollars. And the idea that there's a whole bunch of smart people out there trying to define or develop a new currency, which would be of use to me, is hugely beneficial. Mm-hmm. You know, why should governments have all the fun? The currencies that I'm likely to adopt will be ones that have utility that is based on a store of value. But that doesn't mean that some smart group of people somewhere couldn't develop a crypto that has immediate utility to me in some other fashion. Mm-hmm.
So, Rick, we hit on the uranium subject earlier. And of course, since we last spoke, Sprott established the Physical Uranium Trust. So from a long-term perspective, how important do you think this trust will be in the evolution of this bull market? And do you foresee it, if it gets listed on the New York Stock Exchange, that will be another big step change for the market?
Tom, I'm a little embarrassed to have to answer that question. You know, I'm no longer a Sprott employee. I am the largest shareholder and a director. Sprott had attempted to get control of Uranium Participation Corp, which was the predecessor to our trust, for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And when we succeeded, I knew that it would be an important step in uranium. I didn't understand how seamless and international borders had become. I thought that our ability to raise $500 or $600 million a year, $700 million a year, would occur if we listed on the New York Stock Exchange. The idea that we were able to raise almost $1 billion in 3.5 months being listed in Toronto, mm-hmm, took me completely by surprise. I still believe that if Sprott is able to list the trust on the New York Stock Exchange, the volume that product enjoys on the New York Stock Exchange will surprise people. The truth is that the United States is far and away the largest and most liquid securities market in the world. 92% of equities trading volumes in North America take place in the United States. And having access to the New York Stock Exchange, I think, will really, really democratize that product. But I was astonished by the uptake that we enjoyed on the Toronto Stock Exchange. And I think it was precisely that uptake that took out the overhang in the physical market. We have now established a near-term equilibrium in the market, which is to say that Sprott has bought 20-something million pounds. And that took out the available for sale overhang. We took the uranium price from $25 up to $50, now back to $45. With the momentum out of the increase, the hot money is paying less attention to the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust, but the basic flows into the trust are very, very strong. The next leg up in the uranium market will almost certainly be Japanese restarts. It has come to many people's attention, but most importantly, Japanese voters' attention, that while nuclear energy may have its downsides, any hope that society has of reducing airborne particulate pollution from power generation comes from uranium. And while much is made in uranium circles about the impact that China is going to have in uranium, that impact is 10 years away or 12 years away. You have to build those plants. Mm-hmm. The Japanese plants are built. All you have to do is flip the switch. And 2022 fairly clearly is the year that those switches get flipped. We, meaning Sprott, bought something like 22 million more pounds of uranium. the Japanese will consume 10 or 12 million pounds a year ad infinitum. And that's important. As you see momentum reestablished in the uranium price, because the uranium price has to go up to the cost of production, you will see added inflows into the Sprott Trust. It's been noted that there's a flywheel effect. As people come into the sort of dominant vehicles and gets redeployed, the impact is magnified. Make no mistake, the incentive price for uranium was in the sort of $60 a pound range, but the incentive price is going up. There's inflation in supply changes. There's increasing social rents. My suspicion, although I don't know this, is that the incentive price a year and a half or 2 years from now will be $70 or $75 a pound. And I believe in my mind that given the utility that uranium exhibits, that the price of uranium in the two or three year time frame goes from $45 a pound to some number like $70 a pound. Mm-hmm. And I believe that uranium will ratchet higher, partially based on the pace of Japanese restarts, partially based on the existence of a vehicle that allows people to own uranium. You know, it's not something you want to stack at home, as an example, and partly simply on its utility. So I'm bullish on all accounts. That doesn't mean, by the way, that somebody who buys it is going to get gratification next week. This stuff is up and down like crazy. Right now, I believe that the momentum is out of the trade. And so I think that the hot money is going to get away from it. Justin Hume, who I follow a lot, micro commentator in the uranium business, points out that the uranium equities represented by the two ETFs, one of which is a Sprott product, are floating with violating their 200-day moving averages to the downside. I hope that's true. I hope they crash through the downside. I hope the uranium equities get battered in the near term because I'd like to buy a lot of them. I think it's much more likely than not that over 2 or 3 years, the price of uranium goes from $45 to $75. And I think that a well-chosen portfolio of uranium equities has between 100 and 300% upside. And I think this is much more likely to occur than not. It just won't occur on a time frame that's comfortable for people who haven't studied it. Given that I don't happen to inhabit that camp, for me, it's a wonderful set of circumstances. It's idyllic. Mm-hmm.
So, Rick, when you talk about the properly chosen uranium portfolio, are you looking at projects in that space that are closest to production to be able to take advantage of that next leg up?
I'm fairly agnostic. I mean, where I'm seeing the value right now is, well, in Kazatomprom. The largest and most solvent, lowest cost uranium producer in the world. It's priced at a discount to the penny dreadfuls, which is interesting to me. But I would be happy in the right set of circumstances to buy a large deposit that wasn't economic at $45 uranium, but would be economic at $60 uranium if it were cheap enough. Mm-hmm. The problem is that those deposits 6 months ago, the market capitalizations of those deposits got so high that the market capitalizations discounted higher uranium prices. In other words, I wasn't getting the upside for free, which was not my idea of a good time. So I would buy optionality in uranium if it was cheap. I would buy a project that was undeveloped if I saw the net present value of the deposit relative to the market cap being high enough, or the market cap conversely being low enough, that it offered me a competitive value in terms of time value of money. I would look, too, at strategic situations. There are at least two uranium companies that I'm aware of. No, I'm not going to give out the names because I'm going to be buying them, that I think are strategic to acquirers. I think they have to be bought. And I think that they'll increase in value once they're part of a larger fold for strategic reasons. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to be fairly agnostic as to the strategy I employ.
Do you think, though, that that time lag between, you know, proving that resource and actually getting that resource into production is a major hurdle to be, you know, heeded over this time cycle?
I think speculators will have to be careful. I do believe, unfortunately, the rising tide will float all ships, and that you'll be able to make money on mistakes. I've learned myself that counting on making money on mistakes can be very, very costly. So I'm going to try to avoid mistakes at any rate. What I think you're going to see is a change in the structure in the uranium business, partially because of Sprott. I think that you're going to see that the illiquid nature of the spot market will give way to the liquid nature of the Sprott market. I think it's important to note that. And I think that as a consequence of that, more and more of the trading volume in uranium will go away from the spot market and into the term market, which means that you're going to have more stability in pricing. If that happens, companies that have deposits that haven't been able to get put in production because of the volatility around the product prices will be able to be put into production. I think that investors are going to need to pay attention to that on a case-by-case-by-case basis. But the circumstance that you saw in the last uranium bull market, where the price went from $8 to $120, or $140, pardon me, and then back down to $20, I think is very unlikely to occur. Again, at least in that dramatic a fashion. I think from the point of view of the producers know that the consumers of uranium, the utilities, need some certainty of supply. And I think that the utilities have come to understand that the producers need some certainty as to revenue. If you are a Chinese conglomerate, let's say China General Nuclear, and you're building a $6 billion reactor that uses 1 million pounds of fuel a year, it really doesn't matter to you too much whether you're paying $45 a pound or $70 a pound. It turns out that the fuel cost is relative to other costs, but particularly the cost of amortizing the capital. It turns out that the fuel cost is almost irrelevant. In order for you to get the credit facility, the $4 billion or $4.5 billion in debt that you need to build that plant, you need to show the lender that you have access to 30 years worth of fuel supply. You need to show the lender that you have the ability to keep that plant generating power until the loan is paid off. And what I think you're going to see is a market that becomes much more structured in uranium.
Which is probably what everybody needs, barring some other catastrophe. But, you know, as we've talked about on the show many times, we should be on, you know, generation 10 or 20 of these nuclear plants, making them all safer for everyone. But Rick, I'd like to turn a little bit away from the hot subjects, like the precious metals and uranium, but and ask you how much time you spend trying to find other opportunities. You mentioned earlier that you want to look at commodities that are essential to everyday life. So something like copper or tin, or, you know, how much time do you spend looking for opportunities in that space, or anything more exotic like graphene, for example?
Let's answer the question backwards. The graphene and graphite market, well, the graphene market requires more technological competence than I have. I need to be fairly certain that I'm right. I spent about 20 years studying graphene, and I would say that compared to other observers, I'm still an amateur, so I don't try to compete in circumstances where I'm an amateur. I also don't like small markets. The graphite market itself is a very small market, and it turns out that it's a complex market. There's lots of different grades. There's lots of different sizes. There's lots of different applications. And so I avoid small markets like that. By contrast, I love huge markets. I love the copper market. And I particularly like the copper market when it's in the doldrums. But $4 copper is not doldrums. The incentive price to produce copper worldwide is about $3.50 US a pound at today's interest rates. So today's copper prices are high enough that the industry isn't in liquidation. Interestingly, the copper industry isn't attracting very much investment, which is healthy from my viewpoint. We're living worldwide on copper deposits that are as old as I am, which is to say well past their prime. And society is underinvested in copper for 20 or 25 years. But I would regard the outlook for copper as being not as healthy as the outlook for oil and gas, because I see the incentive price for oil and gas being 60, and I see it priced at 45. I love great copper discoveries because copper mines, big copper mines, can make you exquisite amounts of money. You'll remember the first time we talked, my saying years ago that Ivanhoe Mines, developing a superb copper deposit in Congo, was a no-brainer, despite the fact that it's in Congo. Mm-hmm. The money that that mine is throwing off right now puts almost every other economic endeavor in mining in context. A big copper mine is truly a thing of beauty in terms of its ability to spin off cash. And if we don't have a recession or a depression, it is certain that we're going to have a shortage of physical copper 5 years from now, despite the fact that copper is already selling above its incentive price, because copper isn't attracting the capital that normal economics would dictate. Mm-hmm. So I like copper a lot. I just don't like it as much as oil and gas, because oil and gas perversely is cheaper. When you talk about things that I'm doing with my own money, many people don't know that I've been a long time and fairly successful financial services investor too. The other business that I know about is money. And I have for many years either helped start or invest in community banks. And I'm delighted to say that at age 68, I'm involved in a startup bank. Some friends of mine built one of the world's first online banks 20 years ago called EverBank. They grew it from nothing. Ironically, it started on my living room floor as a concept, to a $28 billion bank, which got sold to TIA Cref for $2.6 billion, something like that, after a New York Stock Exchange listing. And I'm backing the same people doing it again. I believe that a business where you serve your customers better than other people do will be a successful business. We proved with EverBank that we could do it. And I believe we're going to do it again. So starting with my own money, I'm backing a team that built one of the first online banks with a view to becoming perhaps the preeminent precious metals lender in the world, with a view to providing project finance for companies that have a hard time getting it, let's say gold mining companies or oil and gas companies, with a view to the fact that since we don't have bricks and mortar, that we can pay higher deposit rates than our competitors do. I'm just delighted to be involved in a circumstance where I'm backing spectacular people around a series of economic events that are, from my point of view, when events rather than if events. Mm-hmm.
And it must be exciting to be able to compete in a stagnant market like the traditional financial system that we see around us, right?
It's exciting to me when people say, how can you compete with Bank of America or Royal Bank? I say, I can't. Mm-hmm. And they can't compete with me either. I don't want to provide 5-year fixed rate first mortgages in Calgary. That's not what I want to do. And Royal Bank doesn't want to lend against your physical gold and silver inventories. Mm-hmm. I do. So, you know, my sort of business goal is hit them where they ain't. Mm-hmm. I believe that we can provide specialized financial services to a fairly large but very defined demographic, the same demographic that I've served for 40 years. And I believe that we can do it in a way where we outcompete other financial institutions, both with the interests of our borrowers and with the interests of our depositors simultaneously, mm-hmm. with room, plenty of room left over in the middle for investors like me.
Rick, while we're on the subject of themes that we don't talk about often on the show, what is the importance of owning high quality farmland to you, and how does it, you know, fit into your investing framework?
I'm delighted you asked me the question. I was, you know, thumping the table on farmland, as you recall, 3 or 4 years ago. And mercifully for me, I followed my own advice. The difficulty now is that in most markets where it's available, farmland is no longer cheap. Mm-hmm. Certainly in the upper Midwest U.S. markets that we've looked at, the median prices per acre for high quality farmland, the stuff that we like to buy, has increased by 40 or 50%. For localized investors in Canada, probably Saskatchewan and Manitoba, still offer some value, particularly because Saskatchewan won't allow non-Canadians to own farmland in Saskatchewan, as I understand it. So you have less competition. But in the areas where I want to buy farmland, most of the joy is gone from that trade. If it comes back into vogue, I'll probably be buying it. I'm not a seller because the rents haven't kept pace, which is to say, as farmland incomes have increased, the rents we enjoy will increase. But right now, farmland is selling at a lower yield than it was selling at 3 or 4 years from now. And I don't like the bargains available in the sector. I think if you're buying it now with a 15-year time frame, you're extremely safe. But I think if you're buying it now with a 5-year time frame, you're probably paying up.
Well, Rick, I want to thank you for a really wide-ranging conversation here. Is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners before we wrap up?
Well, three things, really, given that Rural Investment Media doesn't know what it's going to do when it grows up. I still want to talk to people, and I give them an incentive to do so. So really a three-pronged offer, depending on what your viewers are interested in. First of all, any of you who care what I think about your natural resource portfolio, not natural resource stocks in general, but your portfolio, can find out. Visit a website, ruralinvestmentmedia.com. Link your natural resource investments, your portfolio. Please, by the way, no crypto. Please, no technology stocks. Please, no pot stocks. You know, keep an old man to what he does best. I'll rank those 1 to 10, 1 being best, 10 being worst. I will include, if you want, and you should want it, the Barron's Gold Mining Index chart, which is the best equities index around the gold mining industry that there is, going back 60 years. If you care about broader commodities, just say charts. I will give you 100-year commodity charts that show just how cheap commodities are relative to other asset classes, again, going back 100 years. If any of you are curious about my bank, if you'd like to become a depositor or if you'd like to become a borrower over time, put in the description line from the charts, bank, and we'll keep you on the list to keep you informed as to what we're doing with the bank. And finally, if any of your listeners are accredited investors, I found out that completely unconstrained by securities laws, and I'm going to begin doing this, I can give notice to investors of any private placement that I'm doing. I don't charge you for this. I don't charge the company. I don't get a commission. It's just a way that I can, be part of the process. It doesn't mean that I buy the best private placements of all times. As you know, I'm a very, very, very picky guy. But if you say private placements, and if you're accredited, I'll put you on a list. Now, the list is likely to become quite large, which means if a company's going out to raise $5 million and you're on the list, it does not mean necessarily that you're going to get involved in the private placement. It doesn't mean that. Mm-hmm. Remember, I'm not a broker. I'm not charging the issuer anything. It's not a subscription-based newsletter. I'm not giving you anything. All I'm doing is putting together a service that is free. Ultimately, this may be a service I charge for. If it gets large enough, I won't be charging the issuer, by the way. I'll be charging the subscriber. And I might not be charging the subscriber. It might be that age 69, the right thing for me to do is stay actually retired. But it's something that I've discovered that I've wanted to do for 40 years, but I couldn't do because I was constrained by securities laws. Mm-hmm. Now, not being licensed, I'm not constrained by those laws, so I can. So if you're accredited and if you'd like to know what I'm doing with my own money, include in that request at ruleinvestmentmedia.com, private placements, and I'll put you on the private placement list for free.
Excellent, Rick. Well, we really appreciate those offers for our audience. And of course, your website is ruleinvestmentmedia.com again. Rick, thanks so much for your time and your wisdom today.
Thanks, Tom. And thank you, by the way, for researching before you ask me the questions. It's lovely to have a person that asks me questions in context. It's a real pleasure to be able to deal with a well-thought-out question. So thank you for that.
Well, I appreciate that feedback, Rick. And that's the way I look at my respect and my payment to you for your time and sharing your opinion with us is the small time it takes me to do a little bit of research so that I know exactly where my guest's expertise lies.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rick.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.